of the 6 fires that have occurred in these storage areas in Story County have been caused by lightning. Can you explain why that might be?
We're just not in a good place with Mother Nature today, I would have to say.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. We just heard a spokesperson for the DuPont ethanol plant speculating as to the cause of the corn stover fire that occurred on Thursday evening just north of Ames and continues to smolder today. More on that in a moment. It's a busy week for us at KHOI as we prepare for our big birthday bash on August 13th. Please plan to join us this Saturday for festivities from noon until 9. Mother Nature has promised a smile on us. Also coming up, a major zine fest happening this weekend in Des Moines. Bob Anders, the host of Bob's 8-Track Garage Sale, checks in with zine artist and our downtown neighbor, Kristen Roach, and explores the zine movement that she is an active part of. Well, yesterday's Story County Supervisor meeting began with a debriefing session regarding a major fire that occurred in a huge bunker of corn stover north of Ames that was being stored for use in the new DuPont ethanol plant in Nevada. This was the 6th such fire in Story County since the company began stockpiling the material in 2012. The plant was scheduled to open at the end of 2014, but they have just not quite got there yet. Corn stover is the stalk of the corn plant, often used as cattle feed or left on the field to replenish the organic matter and nutrients. The DuPont plant in Nevada, when it was first conceived, was the first of its kind in the world, and it plans to convert this material into ethanol for use as fuel in vehicles. So the fire on Thursday night, carrying on into Friday and then continuing to smolder throughout the weekend, demolished 20,000 large bales, equivalent to 5,000 acres of corn, and drew out volunteers and paid firefighters from at least 6 different locales: Nevada, Roland, Gilbert, McCallsburg, Ziering, and Ames, and caused Story County engineers to close a 1-mile section of gravel road parallel to and just next to Highway 35. The last such fire was in 2014 and led to a lawsuit by neighbors who felt the company had ignored the safety hazards of storing the material. With me is Ray Reynolds. He's the fire chief of Nevada. But before we speak with him, let's listen to DuPont Company spokesman John Peepers talk about the cause of the fire. Now, there has been talk of arson in relation to these fires, but according to the testimony yesterday at Story County Supervisors meeting, only one of the 6 stover fires in Story County was set maliciously. John manages the supply chain for DuPont of the corn stover from the farmer to the company. So I asked him about the combustibility of this material, whether there was any parallel between barn fires that are created when alfalfa is stored, particularly if it's stored wet, and the corn stover fires. He said no.
In alfalfa hay and other forage crops, you have abundant sugars available. And when you store that and get it a little too wet or moisture gets into it, those sugars with the moisture and warm temperatures provide a great condition for microbial to start to work on it, and as they digest, they release heat, and that material will heat up and sometimes self-combust. This material has no free sugars. It's made up of carbohydrates. It's not a great direct food source. I like to say it's like eating celery instead of a peach. And so what we have to do in our plant is to convert those carbohydrates to sugars before we can ferment. When we come back to storage then, because there's no free sugars, this has virtually no self-combustion risk. We have tested that. Iowa State's done extensive studies on it, and they say that the self-combustion risk is zero. We believe that there's probably just a tick higher than zero risk, but we've never experienced any self-combustion issues with stover storage.
Okay, so four of the six fires that have occurred in these storage areas in Story County have been caused by lightning. Can you explain why that might be?
We're just not in a good place with Mother Nature today, I would have to say. We're working with experts on lightning. Lightning in total isn't well understood, and lightning on this kind of material has not been studied before, so we're engaging in those studies. We don't know. We don't know why we're having these fires from lightning strikes.
So, quite surprising answer in the midst of this great scientific community of Iowa State to hear that Mother Nature is at the root of this. The supervisors yesterday asked about, you know, what about the degradation of this corn stover? How long is its life? Pieper's response was that if it stays dry, the material is good indefinitely, but if it does get wet, it degrades within 4 months or so. So they have that struggle also. Some of the bales likely have decomposed due to contact with moisture. He said a little bit more about this lightning issue. Let's listen to that.
The insurance companies have told us that in over 30 years of insuring similar material with farmers, they've never had a lightning claim. And when we talk to lightning experts, they have never studied this kind of material. So that work is ongoing as well to try to figure out what is the way to protect this material from that kind of a strike.
So basically the reason that the corn stover burns is that it's dry organic material. And the comparison that John Pieper's made to me, Ray Reynolds, fire chief of Nevada, was that it's just like a cornfield in the fall that might catch fire and burn.
That's correct. Greta, one of the interesting things is I, too, have done a little bit of research into lightning because we have other materials in homes that are subject to failure with lightning strikes. And one of the things that, while I'm no expert in lightning, I have learned that Iowa is in the top three in our nation for lightning strikes. So we deal with this on corrugated stainless steel tubing, which is gas piping in houses. So that was kind of a shock to us to find out that we're one of the top three. Iowa, Texas, and Indiana suffer the most lightning strikes in our nation.
It's fascinating. One thinks that it might be just random, you know, as long as there's a storm that
Yeah, I'm not sure why I was attractive to lightning, but, you know, in this case, when we were doing the fire investigation, the emergency manager was able to help us with a lightning map from the National Weather Service, and we were able to show that at 6:24, there was a direct strike on this stover pile.
Yeah, I heard that in the testimony and found that very interesting as well, that they do map the lightning strikes. Talk about fires in cornfields. How common is that? Is that something that happens a lot? Or I don't think I've ever seen it. So,
yeah, I would say we get called to probably one or two cornfield fires in the fall with standing corn. A lot of it is attributed to overheating farm equipment, bearings or stalks that get inside the harvesting equipment. We have seen some that come from a roadside where somebody discards a cigarette and the fires travel into the dry corn. When we had the droughts back in, I believe it was 12 or 13, we were seeing a larger number of wildland fires and crop fires.
But we've had a couple of rainy falls, so maybe that's not been such a problem lately. Well, you came on board the Nevada Fire Department 2 years ago, and obviously must have been briefed about this. We're very aware of these issues. Maybe you can talk to us about what was the scene back in 2014 with the last major fire at a corn stover storage place, and, you know, what did you learn from that, and how did that affect how you're approaching this time around?
Right. When I first came on board, there was a lot of talk about the stover fire because it was a week old or so. It was very fresh. It was a fire that our folks in several departments throughout the county were on scene for over 24 hours. You know, when you look at some of the departments in our community, the cost of, you know, having volunteers out there for 24 hours, the equipment, the fuel and stuff, it was just, it's very hard to absorb in a smaller community. One of the things that we looked at right away is I've been a firefighter for 30 years, and I don't know that anybody's ever found a good answer for hay bales burning, corn stalk burning. And our strategy that we've found throughout the course of the last 30 years is the quicker it burns up, the quicker you go home. And so in the corn stover situation, I think one of the things that we were looking at is the amount of water it would take to keep things in check, to just even keep things in check, because as we were seeing with the different winds traveling, the it was very hard to kind of control a stover fire, because as you think about it, these fires are happening in lightning. They're happening in windy conditions and stormy conditions. The grounds are wet. And so it's just a very difficult situation to try and extinguish. And at the end of the day, I don't know if you really ever extinguish a combustible that's burning like this. So our strategy has always been to kind of keep it in check. After the 2014 fire, we approached DuPont and said, look, our communities, we can't afford to drain our water supply to try and put out, you know, large fires. And DuPont has been phenomenal to work with. Their strategy is, we don't want to get anybody hurt, and it's corn stalks. And if it comes to a point where we can't stop it, our strategy is we just prefer to be able to contain it on the property. So that was a strategy we took, and that was a strategy we employed on this particular fire once the winds changed, and we lost the fight on this one.
So when you say contain, these storage sites, they have several huge rows of big, long rows of bales. And then there's a break between, like, there'll be several rows of bales, and then there's a big break, and then several more rows of bales, and then a break. And so you just wanted to make sure that it didn't get over that big break.
No, actually, when we first started Thursday night, we felt that it was half of a row. And we felt like if we could contain the fire from jumping onto another row, that we may be successful in stopping it. In fact, we worked for about 4 hours. DuPont brought in large equipment. They were starting to pull bales out from the middle so that we could create a fire break and what was burning would burn. And our strategy seemed to be working. We thought, you know, after 4 hours, we've used, you know, a little bit of water to keep it from hopping over to the next row. But as Mother Nature would have it, there was about a 20-minute section of time when I think it was around 10 o'clock where the winds just shifted 180 degrees. The storm came through, and it was blowing embers over the entire stack. And then once the second row got started, we pulled our crews out and said, you know, it's time to turn this over to the property owner, because you know, it's hard enough to control one stack just to keep it in check. But when the winds are blowing embers over the entire pile, it was we realized that we weren't going to save that pad.
Okay, so it went from half a row to 10 rows that got demolished?
No, actually, it started Thursday night with half a row was on fire. The embers started carrying into the other stacks, and then four additional stacks started, or rows. The following day, the winds shifted on Friday. We had pretty strong winds, about 20 mile an hour, and they were blowing to the south. And those winds actually were carrying embers into the second pad, and that's what ignited the second pad. Our strategy on Friday and throughout the remaining couple of days has been to protect the north stack. So we put up fire curtains. They're basically a wall of fire of water. And our thoughts were that we were able to maybe contain some of the embers. And that's kind of what we're learning, is that these traveling embers are what's causing these other stacks to burn. It's not necessarily the radiant heat that's going off and starting them, but the embers that are traveling through. And I think that's where a lot of the community's frustration is that, you know, they're getting ash and embers that are traveling a significant distance. So those are all the things that we're going to be discussing in an after-action review of this incident and the others, and see if we can work with DuPont and the Board of Supervisors and all the players at the table and kind of figure out, just wrap our hands around this. I think one thing that's important to mention is this was rather new technology, this whole cellulose ethanol, and first of its kind, and it landed in Nevada, which we're grateful for. But now it's important for us to have safe storage sites. And so we've been having discussions with DuPont. We will continue to have those discussions. But I think at this point now we're accelerating those discussions.
Okay. Well, that leads me right into Rick Sanders in the meeting had a comment similar to yours. And let's hear from him.
It feels to me like we had the last, what I would consider, fairly major fire, and there was an immediate reaction. DuPont was great about contributing money to the fire suppression center, and it looked like we were full speed ahead and really trying to analyze these things, and then it just feels like it kind of petered, you know, the enthusiasm kind of petered out, and we didn't get, in my view, to the end of some of those conversations. Let's make sure we get to the end of the conversations this time. We're the first place in America that's dealing with this thing.
So your point exactly that this is experimental territory.
Well, I think I'd rather Nevada be known for the agency that solves this issue, because this is going to crop up throughout our nation. Again, like I said, in 30 years, we haven't figured out how to put out a hay bale fire because you can't. There's not enough water because of the compacted fuels. But what happened last time was we reached out to the state fire marshal's office, Fire Service Training Bureau. They do a lot of fire research or have access to NIST and some of the other federal agencies that may be able to provide some assistance on research that we would have. DuPont donated probably 12 or 20 bales for the research, and I don't know that it ever went anywhere. We had some ideas and thoughts, and we've reached out to, like, the airport fire department and said, what if we were to light 10 of these on fire? Could we use a crash truck and see if the foam would put it out? We're also, as firefighters, we don't like to leave a fire burning when we leave the field, when we go back to station. And so a lot of our firefighters were like, well, what if we pump CO2 into these bales? And so there's a lot of speculation about, you know, different strategies and techniques. So one of the benefits of having been the state fire marshal is having access to a lot of smart people that do this kind of research. I've reached out to the International Association of Fire Chiefs, the National Association of State Fire Marshals, and Underwriters Laboratory. So we're actually asking that question: how do you put out a corn stover fire? What is the best tactic? And in all of our experience, you have three options. You can remove the oxygen, you can remove the heat, or you can remove the fuel. And so in an open air field environment, it's going to be extremely difficult to remove the oxygen. I think what we've seen in these fires is they're very hot. And so the fact that you can burn 20,000 bales in 5 days tells you that that's a pretty hot fire. So it's very difficult to remove the heat. And so your other option is removing the fuel. And that was kind of our strategy Thursday night. But again, every time our folks have fought one of these fires, we've had unpredictable winds. We've had lightning. We've had, you know, just traveling embers. And so for us, at this particular point, the priority is making sure that we're not having secondary fires down the road, you know, a quarter mile, a mile away from traveling embers. But I know that's very little consolation when folks is, you know, buildings and farms and vehicles are covered in ash. So that's been a real challenge.
The company spokesman, John Peepers, was explaining, of course, that a large part of this problem is due to the fact that the plant has not gotten online on schedule. And he said that it would be online by the end of the year. You know, all of this material has stockpiled. In the future, you know, he says it's going to be smaller storage sites, and some of those storage sites will also be on the farmers' property themselves. But to me, that seems to open up another can of worms. If the storage site is on the farmer's property, it's that much closer to buildings and things that really need to be protected.
Well, I think he's absolutely right. You know, But one of the things that in my discussions as the fire chief and inspecting around DuPont and everything is their commitment was that we want to do it right. We don't want to open and enclose and fix things that we find, and we want to make sure that this plant is fully functional before we turn the switch on. And so I commend them for that approach. And the downfall of that is that, yes, we do have a little bit of additional Stover stored up. I don't know the answer to the Stover thing, but I can tell you that our commitment is to find the folks that will help us. At the end of the day, we may still have the same answer: is it's faster and more feasible to let it burn. And I just don't know that the large amounts of Stover piles, that's an acceptable answer for us, because as we're seeing, this is an anomaly. This has happened a few times. And the other thing that we're seeing is it is an inconvenience. It does affect air quality. And I think one of the lessons we've learned out of this is folks want to know if there's something going on. And so while we put out a message about air quality on our social media and the emergency manager, we're actually going to have those discussions about how do we alert the public that this is going on and they may be better off inside their house than out. So I think all of those things are going to come to the table. We're having an after-action session. We're working on schedules now to bring everybody to the table and just to have a roundtable about these discussions. I've always said that problems get solved when you bring everybody to the table and not when one entity is trying to do it. But boy, I'd sure like to find a way to put out a hay bale fire, a corn stover fire, and who knows, maybe that will be a model for the nation.
Well, that's an ambitious task, but it looks like you're up to it. You've already done a lot of networking, it sounds like. What about a lightning rod in these situations? Would that help at all?
You know, I'm no electrical engineer, but I've heard that discussion when we were talking about the corrugated gas piping issues with lightning strikes. And one of the things that the electrical engineers have suggested is that we've taken away lightning rods off of homes and we put aluminum flues in, you know, the chimneys, and lightning, it's attracted to those higher metal objects seeking a path to ground. We've had that discussion as, I mean, if the money was no object, why don't we just build this huge building over them and have lightning rods? You know, one of the things that we've found is even through the ground, lightning current travels. In Johnston, for instance, there was a lightning strike in the middle of the road and two houses caught on fire. And so we know then that current is traveling through the ground as well. So I don't know enough about grounding and protection and lightning. Certainly, I know DuPont is having those discussions. I know that they've put some lightning protection around some anticipated local storage at the plant. But, you know, to know whether it works or not, I think that'll be the big question.
Wow, that is fascinating stuff. We need to bring Ben Franklin back and help us research this topic.
You know, if Ben Franklin was around, I think maybe we'd have some smarter minds than us to figure this out. But I can tell you that everybody that we've talked to does want to solve this issue.
Well, thank you so much, Ray Reynolds, for coming by. Ray Reynolds, the Nevada fire chief, who was out there Thursday night, Friday. How late did you stay up?
Well, it's not necessarily about me. It's about all those volunteers and that answer the call. I get paid to show up to fires, and the volunteers in our community and other communities. And our hats go off because all we do is page them. Folks from Roland, Gilbert, Maxwell, Ziering, you know, anytime we've needed something, other communities come. And that's just what we do in the fire service. But we started at 6:48 was the time of the call, and we left site about 10:30, 10:45, and then it's back at the station cleaning the equipment and hoses and putting the trucks in service. So most of the folks get out of the station about 12:30 in the morning and then get a few hours of sleep before they go to their jobs.
Well, yes, hats off to them. Thank you for reminding us. Yes, there's a reason for this music. This August is KHOI's birthday month, and we went on the air in August 2012, so it is our fourth birthday. This year, you are invited to KHOI's birthday celebration on Saturday, August 13th. Festivities will be happening both inside the station and out on the street with a block party, complete with balloons, basketball, music, barbecue, a book sale, blueberry pies, and blues, and some boogieing going down. Vivica Dillard, the host of KHOI's show, The Hot Spot, put together a whole team of radio hosts, interns, and volunteers who've been working hard for weeks to put it all together. They plan to make this an annual event, but we want to see you there. KHOI intern Zach Neuendorf asked Vivica Dillard to tell you in her own words why she instigated this birthday party.
The birthday bash came about just from an idea because I wanted to do something for KHOI just for the summer. You know, and originally I approached Ursula with the idea of having a 3-on-3 basketball tournament. And then she told me that someone approached her about having a book sale. And so my mind just went from there. And, you know, the train just got rolling from that point.
What can we expect for the birthday bash?
For the birthday bash, you can expect an all-day fun-filled event for the family, for the community, just for everyone. If you don't want to play basketball, you can come and watch.
Are there going to be prizes? What are the requirements?
We do have prizes. So first, I'll do the requirements first. The requirements are ages 13 and up. So we definitely need you to be 13 and up. That way, you know, have some type of basketball skills. So 13 and up, $24 per team. Each team must consist of at least 3 members, though that's very key. Just because it's a 3-on-3 tournament does not mean you cannot sign up with 5 people. Actually, I recommend you do that so you have a substitute. And each game is going to be broken up into 2 halves, and it's going to be tournament style, so bring your A game, because at the end, the winning team receives free passes to the Ames Aquatic Center, amongst some other prizes. We have a special surprise prize for everyone as well, but the Aquatic Center passes, that is definitely what's on the line right now. Bring out your lawn chairs and just enjoy just a nice day downtown Ames on a Saturday. There will be entertainers, so you can come out and enjoy some music. This is August 13th from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and basketball registration remains open as of right now. Knock on wood, we sell out everything the day of. But, the registration is still open, and it will remain open that same day. The basketball tournament will start at noon. At 11 a.m., the doors will open for the book sale, though.
What does the scene look like for the street? Like, how is it going to be set up? Where are the events going to be taking place? Like, the best way you could describe over the radio what someone can expect to see.
So we're going to have that whole area from south of the radio station to the stop sign north, right at the intersection of 5th Street and Douglas, I believe that is, just before the Ames Public Library. So that whole area, this whole street is going to be shut down. It'll be a basketball rim in the middle. It'll be Willie's Barbecue. Food truck will be in the middle. It'll be a lot.
And you mentioned entertainers earlier. What can we expect in terms of music?
Some local talent. We will have Vinyl Vagabonds. Yep. We have about 2 or 3 more performers, as well as myself. Now, I'm not going to be performing, just providing the soundtrack throughout the evening when no one is performing.
Oh, you'll be DJing?
Yes.
What kind of music can we expect from your DJ set?
Hip-hop. Hippity hop, a bunch of it. So, it'll be clean, though, so no worries.
And then you mentioned Willie's Barbecue for food. What other sort of ways can people feed themselves?
Well, actually, we have one of our volunteers here, Greta, is making a gang of blueberry pies. And you can buy them by the slice. You can buy the whole pie if you'd like. The pies are going to be for sale. We'll have corn on the cob. We'll have some potato salad. We'll have some pop, water. Whatever you need. We're going to make sure, if you're going to be out there all day, we're going to make sure you don't starve. We might have a couple other volunteers making a couple other meals, but...
What about the book sale? Can we expect?
There are so many books, from the Carrie Diaries to the Book of Buddhism to the Bible to how to make a crepe. There are so many different books, and I just would recommend... And it's not just books, it's CDs. We have vinyls. We have... We have a couple National Geographic collections as well. Hopefully, I was trying to hide it. Hopefully, no one buys it. No. But, But yeah, there's a very broad collection, very wide selection of books and vinyls and CDs and tapes and everything. And if you feel, if the spirit moves you and you got some books, you have vinyl, you CDs, cassettes, DVDs, whatever it is, the donations for the book sale hasn't stopped. Bring it down. Bring it down to KHOI and we will definitely put it on the shelves for our book sale.
And this is the fourth birthday, which isn't like even a momentous like birthday. Like people usually don't make a big deal about the fourth.
Yeah.
But next year would be the fifth. Could you imagine this being an event that would be traditional?
That is the goal. I'm pulling my hair. All of my hair is turning gray for a reason. So if next year we can get to the point where this is just, it's a no-brainer what we're going to do for our birthday, we might add like one more special thing or might up the prizes or something. Mm-hmm. But that the goal is to make this an annual thing because, like I said, it's a great way to bring out the community towards the end of the summer. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. it's something good for not just us. That the ultimate goal is to have this be an annual celebration.
How long have you been volunteering with KHOI?
This summer made 2 years. Yeah, this summer made 2 years.
And what's the extent of your volunteering here? Like, what do you do?
Now event coordinating.
We're very grateful, yes.
I do have a show every Saturday night called The Hotspot from 8 to 9. Also, I do a lot of other small things that go, you know, that happen in the background at KHOI. I do a lot of, as far as volunteering goes. But yeah, my show, that's like one of the main things that I do. So it's 1 hour every Saturday night, but a lot goes into it.
Since this is a birthday bash celebration for KHOI, could you speak about what KHOI means for the community, why it's so important to Ames?
I like to tell people it's for the community, by the community, KHOI, because we offer a lot of different things, just a lot of different programs. Like, you never know what you're going to hear when you turn on 89.1, or if you go online, shout out to all our online listeners. I think that because we rely so much on the community, it makes us more personable. People know that we're here. They're willing to work with us because we're here for them. We're providing a free service for them. Mm-hmm. And who doesn't love free services?
And that was Vivica Dillard, our fearless leader in this enterprise of putting on our fourth birthday bash. She's been a great organizer and just won't take no for an answer. And she refuses to see the glass as anything but, I don't know, three quarters full. So she's... She's got us all moving. Let me tell you about the music a little bit. You're listening to Local Talk, by the way. My name is Greta Anderson. I'm your host for today. And we can give you a few more details as they have shaken out with the music. The Vinyl Vagabonds will be playing, I believe, at 7 o'clock-ish, from 7 to 9. They are a really great local band, play Motown, rockabilly, good stuff to move to, and songs that you'll know and love. Jebediah Stone from Boone, I believe, or perhaps Fort Dodge is maybe where they had their roots. Heard them the other weekend at the, what is it called? The Stock something. You know that
Shagstock,
right? Shagstock, yes. Jebediah Stone played, and they had they were playing Grateful Dead type tunes. It was really nice to hear, actually, not just one tune by the Grateful Dead, but you know how they bridged to a second song, like Scarlet Begonias into Fire on the Mountain. You know, that kind of thing. They did that, so it was really wonderful. They also profess a love of Jethro Tull, so expect that kind of music. And then from 3 to 5, we have, coming down from Minneapolis, a hip-hop artist, Dima Cash. So we're very interested in hearing his talent and what he's going to offer us. So music is going to be awesome. It's going to be loud and fun. As for the blueberry pies, I've made the executive decision to offer a free slice to people who come. So you can buy a small pie or get a piece of pie for free. And as for the Willie's Barbecue, we did talk to Willie about his life and times as a barbecue chef. He's been doing a barbecue truck for 3 years. You might have seen him at the farmer's market with his daughters, his lovely daughters. used to make barbecue in his backyard in Des Moines. So many people liked it and told him he should sell it that he started a food truck. And he wants to start a restaurant called Willie's, and he is looking around Ames as well as Des Moines for a location. He came to Ames for the farmer's market and loves coming here because he is received so well. And his most popular dish is the brisket. So bring a little cash with you for books. Bring a little cash with you for food. But you'll get some good stuff, too. As for books, I just brought a few into the studio. We've got a book called The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science. We've got Suspicion Nation by Lisa Bloom. Iowa's Wild Places by Carl Kurtz, the great prairie expert of Iowa. It's a beautiful book. The Help by Catherine Stockett, the very entertaining novel of a woman encountering a group of women, the African-American servants of the white upper-class society in the South. Interesting story. And let's see, a book on Palestine. I think there's more than one book on Palestine issues in our stack. So as you can see, KHOI listeners are intelligent, informed people, and they make good choices when they buy books. So you can expect to find a lot of good, interesting books at our book sale, and you can make some good, intelligent choices yourself when you come down and buy our books. Thank you so much to everyone who's donated those books, by the way. As for our last story, Bob Anders, our Thursday morning DJ at 11 o'clock, he plays Bob's 8-Track Garage Sale, and it's a really wonderful show. It's got a following already where he plays 8-Tracks on the air and in kind of a random order, whatever strikes his fancy at the moment, and it doesn't necessarily have to seg from the thing that came before. Bob is interested in zines, and so he interviewed a local zine maker and actually our neighbor, because she set up shop down the street just half a block away from us. Kristen Roach is going to be very busy this weekend because there is a zine festival in Des Moines. So Bob Anders was on this scoop and has a story for us now.
My guest today is Kristen Roach. Kristen Roach is a resident of the city of Ames. She's a retail business person from downtown Ames. She has her own store, and she has several online businesses. She's an artist and a mom. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Kristen, tell us about your retail business here in downtown Ames, right on Main Street.
Yeah, so 3 months ago, Jason and I took the plunge and we opened up Littlewood's Herbs and Tea. It's located at 136 Main Street. And we are an apothecary-style tea bar, and we offer a wide range of culinary herbs and spices, loose-leaf teas, and teas that we blend ourselves in-house. We also have brewed tea for there to go.
And you have several online businesses, or have operated them in the past and currently do now. And I know one of the businesses has to do with our topic, which is the art of the zine. What are those online businesses, Kristen?
Well, Littlewood's Herbal actually started out online as littlewoodsherbal.com, and then we transitioned into farmers markets and then now the retail location. Other than that, I was a craft pattern writer for quite a while and ran a blog, craftleftovers.com. And then more recently, in 2013, I started roach-motel.com, which is an online as well as physical zine distro that's had several locations around central Iowa and is now kind of residing in my office space at Littlewood's.
That's awesome. And you are an artist. Tell us about your artwork and your recent exhibits.
Yeah, so I've exhibited kind of around central Iowa and a little beyond. I primarily work in fiber-related medium. My background in craft pattern writing kind of lends itself to that. And I use a lot of leftover supplies, a lot of environmental supplies to make my work. And they tend to be sculptural installations and line drawings.
And you are a mom. Tell us about your beautiful daughter.
Yeah, Lucy Lynn. She's a sweetheart. She's 3 years old next week. A real spitfire.
Okay, now we're going to get right into the topic. What is a zine and what does it look like?
The easiest way to think about it is the kind of where the word came from, which is magazine. If you just chop off MAGA, you get a zine. So think a smaller, handmade, self-published magazine. They usually look like little pamphlets or booklets. They can be handmade, hand-bound, or they can be printed at, say, a local print shop and professionally bound. And what it is it's really something that tends to be uncensored, very raw, kind of uncut, but they can have editors. But the main thing is that it's really tied to this notion of uncensored content.
And also it's ephemeral. A lot of people think that I know I have a collection of zines at home and I kind of hold on to them, but if something happened or I happen to lose one, it's not the end of the world.
It's not. And it's also, they're usually one of a kind. With best intentions, it's really more rare that a zine maker will produce a series. I think because I came at it from a different industry, I ended up producing somewhere around 46 zines in the Craft Leftovers series. That's more the exception than the rule. A lot of times they're one-offs where it's just on a random topic that suits your fancy. You slam it together, photocopy it at work, and give it to all your friends.
Now, speaking of random and the topics, let's talk about the history of zine making. Essentially, Kristen, how long has there been a zine culture, and what are some of the first examples of zines, and what was their purpose, and how has the craft grown?
Those are heady questions I feel ill-equipped to formulate a complete response for. I would say that from what I've read, zines really came into being initially with the printing press. It kind of subversive publications tend to be political satires and that kind of thing. But then when the Xerox copy machine was invented in the last century, it really exploded because then it became the subversive thing to do at work, to stick it to the man. And so it has a lot of roots in the punk rock movement of the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, that I kind of looking back on my history in zines, I think the first zine that I saw was about the time a copy center came to my hometown, and businesses that were prospering and banks, maybe some law offices, had their own copy machines, but probably then people were sneaking copies.
Yeah, disgruntled staff, temp workers, you know.
Yeah.
Borrowing the copy machine for
use. Yes. Well, how long have you personally been involved in the zine culture? And what do you think is your memory of the first zine that you saw that made an impression?
The first one that I ever saw was at a punk rock show in the 90s, definitely not the 70s, in Davenport, Iowa. And this kid, Johnny, was selling them for 50 cents a whack. And so I paid my 50 cents and I thought it was so cool. And I didn't realize, like, the awesome thing about zines is that anyone can make them, even if you're kind of a nerdy girl like myself. And so it wasn't until a couple years later that I started my own zine that was centered around the idea of creativity and using up things that you had laying around the house, or the Craft Leftovers monthly zine.
Okay, so that's very interesting. You actually intermingled your professional life with the zine movement, and you created a series of zines that had to do with your business.
Yeah, well, that was kind of the funny thing about it is, you know, zines are kind of subversive. I'm almost hesitant to admit this on air to the world, but, you know, mine were actually very they were just really fun and almost kind of joyful, and this really raw expression of my, like, love of just, like, tooling around with craft crap in my studio. And so I made one once a month on average for about 5 years, and that, and then the advertising revenue from my blog and kits and going to things like the makers fairs and renegade craft shows was my primary income for like 5 years and or so. And then at the end of that, I actually wrote a book called Mend It Better for Story Publishing. Well, and it was actually because they saw one of my zines on Etsy called Mending on the Go.
That is just fabulous. So now you are the proprietor or is that gender correct, the proprietress of the Roach Motel? Tell us about that Roach Motel.
So my last name is Roach, Kristen M. Roach, like the bug, no joke. And I've always wanted to use the name Roach Motel for something. It just seemed so apropos for my name. And when I was thinking about starting a little distro by renting a shelf from my friend's shop, I was like, oh, this is it, the Roach Motel Zine Distro, because it's kind of seedy and it brings a bunch of weird, eclectic people together, and it's all about all kinds of things. And so that kind of became that. And it's moved around. It was at the Des Moines Social Club for a while, and then more recently at the Iowa Music Store. It started out at where it's at, a little boutique on Main Street. And now it's in my office at Little Woods Herbal. And then in 2017, it's going to move to Reliable Street. And a zine distro really just means distribution. So I'm a distribution point for other people's zines. And I have zines from primarily Ames and Central Iowa, but honestly from all over the world. I even have some from UK and Brazil and Australia that are just real gems. People send them to me from all over the place. And I wouldn't really say I'm the owner of the distro. I just kind of keep it going because it, I feel like it needs to happen. I don't actually make any money off of it. I give the majority of the money back to the consigners, and then the rest of the funds just go to buy more zines.
This is absolutely amazing. It's like, here we are downtown Ames. We've got this charming tea and herb store that has a secret zine distro in the back room. How cool is that, Kristen?
Yes, just come up to the front and ask if there's a vacancy at the Roach Motel, and we'll show you the wares.
Well, this is Bob Anders, and my guest is Kristen Roach, and this is Local Talk, and we're discussing the art of the zine, and that's spelled Z-I-N-E, mm-hmm. The zine. Well, how can a zine, Kristen, how can a zine be used in everyday life? For what purpose? For education or fun? Or what purpose are they?
Well, they kind of have no purpose and any purpose, really. It's whatever you personally want to do. My intention with a zine may be very different than, say, Bob's over here. And sometimes it's poetry, sometimes it's art, sometimes it's self-expression, but other times it's about someone or a culture that's been underrepresented, really expressing their own emotions, state of being, the political turmoil that is going on in their culture where they're underrepresented in popular media. And so it really can be a way to speak out against things or for things, advocacy.
It's interesting because you mentioned that the early zine, I mean, the zine concept started with the creation of the printing press. And as a country, our idea of breaking away from Great Britain was spread by pamphlets that were printed. Benjamin Franklin is an example. A printer printed these things and these pamphlets, and they were out, and they inspired people to seek independence.
Yeah. And if you want to see a whole bunch of zines from all over the region, you should really check out the Roach Motel Zine Fest down at the Vaudeville Muse on August 20th. We have skill building sessions in the morning that you can check out and register for at roach-motel.com. Or you could just come and check out the free zine expo in the afternoon and meet some of the zine makers from the area. And then in the evening, we're having this amazing theatrical musical performance by Samuel Lockwood, Rachel Boozy, Levi Beal, and Rob Steffens. They're doing a rock opera. It's going to be amazing.
Now, how many zine artists will be showing their wares there?
On the low end, there'll be about 36, but there could be as many as 40 or more. And if you also just want to show up with your zines in hand and trade them around, that is absolutely acceptable too.
I will say, Kristen, I've attended a couple different zine fests in the Twin City area, and they've mm-hmm. been going on up there. Actually, the zine culture is alive and well. If you ever get to Powell's Bookstore in Portland, they have an entire section for zines.
Yeah, or Needles and Pens is also an amazing little zine shop in San Francisco. If you've also more closely to us, check out Quimby's or Chicago Comics in Chicago. And those are both really great zine sources.
And so they're actually, you would consider them a zine distro, mm-hmm. very similar to what you have on a smaller scale.
Yes, I actually based what I do on, I sell my zines at all those places.
Well,
so if you want to get craft leftovers in Chicago, you absolutely can over at Quimby's. But I, you know, I looked at their consignment forms and I looked at how they operated and I took on the same model.
Well, this is very exciting. I think it's time that Iowa in general and Central Iowa, Ames in particular, gets on the zine bandwagon.
Yeah.
So if I were listening to this radio show and I thought, how can I get involved? What can I do? Where is the website I can go to find out more?
You want to go to roach-motel.com, and there'll be information on how you can submit a zine to the Roach Motel Distro. There'll be information on the Zine Fest, and we'll also have information on any upcoming events, workshops, gatherings for zine makers.
And I will say I've attended a couple zine workshops in the last year and the last couple months, and a zine workshop is great fun. It's actually children friendly, always. Zines are made by, some people say, well, I'm not an artist, I don't draw well. Well, you don't have to be. You can do cut and paste. You can do collage zines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
a lot of zines are just a collection of people's favorite things. So a lot, I think of, I found this notebook by my great-great aunt that was filled with photo or with cutouts of magazine all compiled together and organized. And I was like, huh, this is essentially a zine in a lot of ways because it was just a compilation of all these things she loves smashed together in one place.
Well, did you reproduce it then?
I'm planning on it.
Well,
I'm absolutely planning on it.
Well, Kristen, I want to thank you for coming in today. This is Bob Anders. I'm a producer at KHOI. My guest is Kristen Roach, and she is the proprietress of the Roach Motel, which is a zine distro or zine distribution center located at the Little Woods Herb and Tea Store on Main Street in downtown Ames. In the back office. Thank you, Kristen.
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started off the show with an interview of John Pieper of DuPont Chemical, who works on developing the supply chain for the corn stover ethanol plant, and Ray Reynolds, Nevada fire chief. We heard from Vivica Dillard, who's planning our birthday celebration, and then Bob Anders interviewed Kristen Roach, as you just heard. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Birthday from The White Album. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday. Thank you.
god of hellfire, and I bring you
fire.
Saved and earned.